Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our program. We may have some additional new listeners today because I know many of you have been following WTDY this week because of, and my hat's off to my colleagues here at WTDY for the outstanding excellence and coverage that has been going on here from this station right here in Madison, Wisconsin, covering one of the biggest issues certainly that has ever been confronted in our state. It has taken on a national message and even international, I understand, as people from around the world are looking at Madison, Wisconsin as the headquarters of how we define our freedom and our workers' rights and our rights of individuals to be participants in our own government. So I want to compliment WTDY. I am so proud to be associated with this station and with Midwest Family Broadcasting and the support that they have dedicated to this issue. I also want to compliment all of you who have been walking around the Capitol, who have been protesting so peacefully and with such joy and enthusiasm and determination. I take exception, and I know this is their just hyperbole and the theatrics of how they get their ratings, but I take exception to people like Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, who call people, who call you, who call our friends and neighbors here in Wisconsin, names like thugs and bottom feeders and freeloaders. If there's anything that Wisconsin citizens are not, it is those terms. And sometimes, you know, you can say that, you can complain about your mother, but don't you complain about my mother. Well, it's the same thing about our friends and neighbors, and I resent it, and I hope that each and every one of you, including our Governor Scott Walker, resents that Wisconsin citizens who are protesting on something that has such legitimacy for discussion are being called such radical and demeaning names. So, and then I have another thought that hasn't been brought up regarding the whole issue of collective bargaining, because that's truly what it has come down to now. The union leaders have said, okay, we will go along with a financial contribution. So let's take that off the table. It's the ability to collectively bargain that is on the table, the ability to, as a group, have worker participation. And if any of you have ever been involved in the quality movement in private industry and business, there is some similarity between the concept of collective bargaining and quality in the private sector. And the quality movement every year is honored and recognized through an award called the Malcolm Baldrige Award. And actually, Malcolm Baldrige was in Ronald Reagan's cabinet when he was president, and he was, I believe, Secretary of Commerce. He was killed in an unfortunate horseback riding accident. But because he was really promoting the idea of quality in business, they named the award after him, the Malcolm Baldrige Award. And business and industries, corporations seek this every year because what it represents is quality in business, both serving the internal and the external customers and exceeding their expectations. And what they have found and what they're being honored for is how the best companies have full participation on the part of all levels. And the ones that are empowered are those that are closest to the customer. So the leadership, the executive, the administration, and management of private industry looks to those frontline workers for input on how best to serve the customer, how best to have processes within an organization work smoothly so that everything can be done efficiently, cost efficiently, and delivered to the customer in a timely basis and served and offered to them in a way that is appealing and has a positive reaction on the part of the customer. And this input from the front line and empowering the front line to take the initiative in the customer to make it the most with the customer to make it the most positive experience possible is what quality is all about. St. Mary's Hospital received the Malcolm Baldrige Award a few years ago, and they were very proud to be recipients of this. And to this day, they will say that in their introductions, that we did receive this award. It seems to me that this is the private sector is comparable to collective bargaining. So on the basis of that, and from my understanding of the situation, the idea of worker participation at all levels of discussion can only make things better. And for that, I give you accolades and I honor your continuing protests. And I hope that people will come to the table, including Governor Walker, who said yesterday that he will not budge on collective bargaining, and he will not budge on sitting down and talking to the leaders of the workers. And I hope that changes, so at least a full, coordinated, in-depth, substantial conversation can ensue on these critical landmark issues that are included in the budget repair bill. So with that said, I will turn to our program today, but we are on live. The phone number is 321-1670, 321-1670, or *123 on your U.S. cellular phone. This program will also be posted on carolcobyradio.com, Carol Coby, K-O-B-Y, radio.com. So if you want to pass it along to others or tune into it at a later date, you will be able to find that beginning late Monday afternoon. Now we'll get into our subject of the day, which is one which is also very close to my heart because I've had a personal experience in it. And we're going to talk about pain and the management of pain. And actually, pain has become a very prominent thing in the healthcare field, and to the point that there is a specialty in it. And I have with me in the studio Kim Litwack, who is an RN, a nurse practitioner, and also has a PhD degree, so she's a doctor of nursing. And she has been working with advanced pain management since 2004. She works in the Madison office, but advanced pain management is in other locations as well, and I'll have Kim explain that to you. Her main responsibilities involve patient care and medical management of patients. And prior to joining advanced pain management, she worked as a family nurse practitioner in orthopedics and school-based health. She is currently the director of the Family Nurse Practitioner Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and in her spare time enjoys antiques and bird watching. I find it fascinating, people who enjoy bird watching. And I have some friends who do that, and it's just amazing. They can look out, and I'm either daydreaming or not seeing something, and look at that bird, and you can, at a great distance, actually identify the bird just by a little speck on its wing or whatever. Is that true, Kim?
No, I'm not that good.
You're not that good, but you know people who are.
I do.
Well, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
And is there a definition for pain that you use in the medical field as a specialty?
Well, if you look at the literature and in the profession that I'm in, we believe that pain is anything that the person says that it is. So when a patient comes to us and says, I'm in pain, we take that patient at their word and ask them for more information. What does that mean to you when they say they have pain? And so we ask an awful lot of questions on that first visit, but it's usually the complaint that brings them into the office.
And if they come to your office, they're coming to people who are specialty is dealing with pain. So right away, you must know that there's an issue going on here.
Absolutely. Sometimes patients self-refer. Sometimes they are referred by other providers. But we know that pain and the impact of pain on their life has become problematic, and that's why they're in our office.
Well, I have found a definition actually that is used for pain, and it's called an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience, often as a result of an actual or potential physical injury. And when we experience pain, our nerves send a signal to our brain to alert the body that something is wrong. Not everyone, however, feels pain equally. Some evidence suggests that age and even gender can affect an individual's tolerance of pain. So when somebody says, oh, I have a high tolerance of pain, or I have a low tolerance, this is actually accurate. And is this because their nerves or their messages to their brains differ?
Well, it can be that their nerves respond differently. It also has to do with prior experience with pain and how much pain someone has experienced. So when we ask a patient, is this the worst headache you've ever had in your life? If it's the only headache, that's the only thing they have to compare to. If it's the only injury, it's the only thing they have to compare it with. Others have had more experience with pain and put it on a scale where, oh, it's not so bad, or this is the worst pain I've ever had.
We hear now that you don't need to live in pain. And that not everybody realizes that. But is that actually true, that if you are suffering great pain, that that pain can be dealt with today in ways that weren't possible before?
Absolutely. In 2001, pain management really became a specialty unto itself. Prior to that time, patients lived with pain and either chalked it up to, I've got to live with it, or it's just because I'm getting older. But now we're realizing that, again, pain management is a specialty. We can help, and it's not just with medications. There's lots of interventions that are possible to help deal with pain so that patients can increase their quality of life.
So pain isn't an aging issue, and that's not a natural part of aging, the aches and pains.
Well, it may be an aging issue because we do find that there are some issues, particularly with the back, that increase when you get older, but you don't have to live with pain, and it should not be viewed as a normal part of aging.
Well, I was just looking up some of the treatments that are offered with pain, and the list is so long that it filled a whole 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. It's just amazing. I'll just briefly go over this, and then when we come back from break, I want you to begin to break down the issues that cause pain and what we can do about those today.
Absolutely.
And what people should know so they don't live with pain in an era when you don't have to. There's over-the-counter drugs, there's acupuncture, anticonvulsants, antidepressants, aspirin, biofeedback, capsaicin, chiropractic treatments, cognitive behavioral therapy, counseling, COX-2 inhibitors, electrical stimulation, TENS, exercise, hypnosis, low-power lasers, magnets, narcotics, nerve blocks, opioids, physical therapy and rehabilitation. Even placebos can make a major difference. And then there's the RICE, the rest, ice, compression, elevation. Finally, surgery. And I didn't even read the whole list. So it's pretty impressive. And it has to be really a complicated, substantial kind of diagnosis process to determine what is going to work best for anyone.
Absolutely.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about the issues that create pain and what can be done about them. You're listening to All About Living on Madison 1670 WTDY. This segment of our program has been brought to you by Gunderson Funeral and Cremation Care, the Life Celebration Center. Stay tuned because we'll be right back with more of All About Living. Welcome back to our program. It's a pleasure to have you with us on this beautiful sunny day in Madison. It's gorgeous. I understand that maybe tomorrow there's going to be some snow, so winter is not over yet, but it's particularly joyful and good for us to have some sunshine. Get out there and get some vitamin D. We're talking about pain management on our program today, and Kim Litwack is here. She is a nurse practitioner and working with Advanced Pain Management in Madison, and that is not the only office that Advanced Pain Management has. You work in the specialty of pain management, which is a separate interdisciplinary specialty in the medical field. And where are the pain management offices? I wasn't that familiar with them.
Advanced Pain Management is the largest interventional pain service in the state of Wisconsin, and we have clinics from Milwaukee and Lake Michigan to the Iowa border to the Illinois border and as far north as Green Bay and Sheboygan. In fact, we've just opened two clinics on the Minnesota side. So we are fairly easily accessible, but Green Bay is about as far north as we're going at this point.
So you are growing, and that must mean there are more increasingly numbers of people who are experiencing pain.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes. Well, let me tell you, to set the scene and the tone about what you do to deal with pain, I've had a personal experience with it. So when Advanced Pain Management, oh, I know what you people are all about. 4 years ago, I brilliantly, working in the kitchen, was holding an avocado in my hand, split it in half, and then it was a little bit difficult to get the pit out. Well, I'm not doing it correctly like Martha Stewart would. I was holding it in my hand, and I took a knife, the end of a knife, to poke out the pit. And it wasn't quite ripe, so the pit didn't come out. So I thought, oh, well, one more jab before I do it like Martha Stewart. And I just jabbed as hard as I could, and my knife went over the pit of the avocado and through my finger. And I'm showing you my finger now, which is this little S curve right in the middle of my hand. And I severed everything. It was just this mashed mess of blood. And I was up north, so I went to an emergency room, ended up here at UW-Madison, and with, you know, hand specialists, the whole thing. Maybe six surgeries later, you know, now I have a fused finger with nothing but steel in it that's bolted together after many, many attempts to try to salvage the finger. In the meantime, because I had severed the nerves and there was an infection, I developed what they called RSD. I'd never heard of RSD before. I learned then that you can cope with anything unless you have pain. And I have learned to, I'm a piano player, I've learned to cope with the fact that I don't have a fully working left hand. I can compensate, not play all the notes, but I went through maybe a year to year and a half of such excruciating nerve pain. And by the way, Rex Charger, our big boss around here who's working the board today, I did not miss one radio show. I showed up and I'm wondering what I said some of those times when I was on the medication. You know, probably opened the show, Better Living Through Drugs or something. But it was terrible. And I was on, you know, Vicodin, sent me out to the pain management clinic, actually, at UW. I had never been through an experience like that. And I'm filling out papers and how suicidal am I? And I was just sitting there moaning and grabbing my hand. And it just, it takes over your whole body. And then some of the medications that kind of dulls you too. So I went through that experience. And finally, after about a year and a half, it passed. And now I have no pain and I'm just fine. It just feels really good, you know, and have my hand rubbed at my finger. So I know how debilitating pain can be. And that is the defining factor, I think, in any illness or injury as to how you get through it. So am I kind of par for the course in describing this?
You're right on target. Pain is a physical sensation in terms of the effect on your body, but it also is an emotional sensation. And so when you use that definition, it's an unpleasant sensory. That makes it sound kind of like a mosquito. It's an unpleasant experience. It can be downright awful. And it not only is physically challenging, but patients who are dealing with chronic pain or persons dealing with chronic pain are not the wives they want to be, the mothers they want to be, the employees they want to be, or the husbands, fathers, spouses, significant others. It affects everything from the minute you get up to the minute you go to bed, and sometimes sleep is not restorative like it used to be. So we do address both the physical and the emotional discomfort. And so when they asked you that question, are you suicidal, most people don't want to commit suicide from pain, but they wish they didn't have to live with pain.
Well, it was amazing to me, the depth and the substance of what they went through to determine the levels of your cognitive abilities and your positive or negative feelings about life in general. Obviously aware of how much pain can take over a person and really change an individual.
Absolutely.
What are the major causes of pain?
The leading cause, without doubt, is back pain. Many people experience back pain. Over 75 million people live with back pain on a daily basis. And I would estimate probably 80% of individuals have had some type of back pain in their lives. Many times, good old Wisconsin winters and shoveling will do it. And I think you addressed that not too long ago.
Yes, yes. In fact, we have a living minute going on, you know, the safe way to snow shovel.
Oh, well, yeah. Sunday night, we may have to be playing that. Yeah. But back pain is one of the leading cause, probably followed closely by headache.
And what can we do to avoid back pain in the first place?
Well, probably the easiest thing is good living. That includes keeping your weight down, keeping active, using good physical conditioning when lifting. We've probably all heard you should bend with your knees and not with your back, which means you have to squat down to pick something up, which is harder to do when you're obese or when you're not in good shape. You want to keep yourself moving.
And what are the major causes of back pain?
Well, when you think about what you've got in your back, you've got bones. So there can be problems with the spine itself in terms of arthritis and narrowing of the bone spaces. There are discs back there, which act as the cushions between the bones. So there are issues with the discs that can be herniated discs or bulging discs. Sometimes people have heard the term slipped disc, which is really just a herniation. There are nerves that come off the spinal cord. So there can be nerve issues as well.
Arthritis is a big problem. And that's what you're describing as being a major cause of back pain. Is there anything we can do about that, or do we just have to manage it and find ways to manage it successfully? But is there anything we can do to prevent it?
Well, prevention starts when we're younger, and unfortunately, sometimes now it's hindsight's 20/20. I wish I had.
Mm-hmm.
But again, keeping weight down, keeping yourself active, whether it's walking, being in a pool, even just walking in a pool.
So that could prevent arthritis from developing
it helps,
later in life.
It yes, absolutely prevents it.
Some people
it.
Seem so prone to it, though. I think there's a genetic component, too.
There is a genetic component, and it also has to do with how much you beat up your body when you're younger. If you're a physical laborer, a lot of physical activity, football players, that kind of abuse of your body or hard, very, very hard work can lead to arthritis. Also, accidents and injuries can lead to arthritis, but you don't have to live with it. There are many ways to treat it, including exercise, keeping your weight down. There are anti-inflammatory medications that can be used, and in worst cases, surgery.
Okay, so let's get into the fact that somebody walks in your office, and if they're there because of arthritic pain, it's pretty severe, and their case is pretty developed. What would you do? What are the options? You mentioned some of the over-the-counters.
And, sure.
But is surgery the only option for the severe cases?
No, absolutely not. That's one of the joys of working in an interventional pain clinic is for many patients we can avoid surgery. There are many techniques where we use needles, guided needles under x-ray, where local anesthetics and or steroids and or use of electrical energy can be used to address pain at the site that it's caused by, either directly at the nerves or the joints in the spine. We do a procedure called medial branch blocks where we diagnostically numb up some of the nerves that go to those arthritic joints in the back. And if we're able to successfully numb them up, we may be able to go on and heat those nerves to cause them to not transmit pain anymore, therefore avoiding surgery or avoiding and limiting or decreasing pain.
People are really fearful of surgery, particularly on the back.
Absolutely.
And are they a greater risk for something going wrong in a back surgery versus other surgeries?
Any surgical procedure involves risk. There's the risk of infection. There's the risk of it not working. The larger the surgery or the more invasive, the greater the risk.
So the other methods you try first, and it must be very individualized.
Absolutely. We start by asking lots of questions. So on an initial visit, patients should plan on being there for almost an hour. We're going to have you fill out, yes, those forms that you mentioned, asking lots of questions. We want to know where the pain is, what you've done in the past. We don't want to repeat what you've already done. If you've tried exercise and that hasn't worked, we'll try something else. We want to look at all the options. And we want to involve the patient as an active decision maker.
So the bottom line, what I'm hearing is that if you're living in that kind of pain, that arthritic pain, which you think, oh, this is going to be a way of life for me, that there is hope. There is something that can be done today. Medicine does have ways of
absolutely.
Treating.
Absolutely. And we welcome the opportunity to sit down with you and discuss and with patients to discuss the options. What do they want to do that they can't do now? And while we can't always get them to that point when they say, well, I wish I could. Well, okay, you can't, but let's take away the pain. Let's talk about the options that are available for pain management to increase your quality of life.
What about migraine headaches? That's another area that just absolutely debilitates people. In fact, there was an experience, was it last week, where absolutely couldn't speak because of the pain from a migraine headache.
Right, the reporter on TV, they
yes.
actually thought she had a stroke
yes.
Because her speech was impaired. Headache requires a very comprehensive workup, and it may involve pain management, it may involve neurology, it may involve internal medicine to find out the underlying cause, because there are lots of causes of headaches that are not migraines. And so our job is to ask lots of questions to determine what the underlying cause of the headache may be and then to address the headache pain itself.
How many of the headaches turn out to actually be migraines?
It's been estimated that 28, 29 million people suffer from migraines. And we do know that there is a familial component so that people who have family members with migraines have a higher incidence of having migraines.
And what actually is a migraine?
A wicked, wicked headache.
Oh.
For some patients, they describe it as the worst headache they've ever had in their life. Some people know that they're coming. Some don't. At worst case scenarios, it may put people in bed for 2 or 3 days. They are very light sensitive, so they want to be in a dark room. They're very noise sensitive. They want to be in a quiet room. Some people are nauseated when they get headaches. Standing upright for some people makes it worse. Everyone's got their own kind of pattern of how they present.
And it being a migraine because of what? It's on one side of the head. I heard that. I don't know how accurate that is.
For some people, it's one side. Others, it's both sides. It's a very, very intense pattern. For some, they know their triggers, lack of sleep, certain medications, red wine for some people. But we have to ask lots of questions.
And is there a way to prevent them? If what people's triggers are, you stay away from those triggers, I would imagine.
Absolutely. That's really the only way to avoid is we ask patients to keep what we call a headache diary. When do they get their headaches? Keep track of it on the calendar. For some women, it's related to their period, so we may use hormones to help regulate their periods. For others, it's foods, so we try and avoid those foods. And for others, there is no trigger. It just happens, and then we try and come up with a strategy to deal with that.
So if somebody is listening and they do experience headaches, keeping a diary would be one of the good things that they could do at this point before they would visit their physician or go to a pain management clinic such as yours. Because if they come with that information, you can get on top of it quicker.
Absolutely. Then we don't have to say, go home and keep a headache diary. They've already come in. So that helps answer a lot of questions right up front.
All right. And then what are the various ways that you can treat headaches?
Well, for starters, we want to make sure there's not an underlying medical condition causing a headache. And when a patient comes in and says this is the worst headache they've ever had in their life, we have to make sure it's not a stroke or something serious going on. That would be the first thing that they'd rule out in an emergency room. Usually patients that come to us have been dealing with chronic headaches and don't have other neurologic indicators that it is a stroke. So we're going to ask questions. Some people can treat migraines simply by ibuprofen or Tylenol. Others treat it with more complex medications, preventative and or injectables.
Are we having more medications come on the market now?
There's all kinds of medications that are out. We used to think opioids and narcotics were the only way to treat headaches, and now we find that those actually are probably not the best way to treat headaches. Evidence is not supporting those. So we have what we call neuromodulators, which is kind of a fancy word for medications that change the way nerves function. And we're having much more success with those medications.
Okay. We're going to stop for a break. When we come back, I want to talk about cancer pain, which is oftentimes the worst part of cancer treatment, and issues like fibromyalgia, which is something that has kind of cropped up in the last 10 or 20 years, and I had never been raised with that being a familiar term. So dealing with some of the issues that seem to have sprung up in recent years. Our guest today on All About Living is Kim Litwack, who's a nurse practitioner with Advanced Pain Management. This segment of our program has been brought to you by Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, where expertise with compassion is powerful medicine. I'm Carol Colby. You're listening to All About Living here on WTTY 1670. We'll be right back after these messages. We're back with our program, and earlier I said that Rex Charger is here as the producer of our program today. We're live on WTDY because Rex is here. He's here a lot because he's the big boss, and these are very busy days at WTDY. But also, Jason Stapleman, who is the producer of this program on Saturdays, and he's been with me since day one, which is almost, it'll be 9 years in April. Well, Jason and his lovely wife, Katie, have just announced the birth of their third child, and little Sam was born this week. They have Lane, which is their oldest child now, and their little girl, Lane. And then there's Henry, who is about 18 months, and now Sam has come along. And so congratulations to Jason and Katie and to Lane and Henry on their new little baby brother. And so Jason will be back, I'm sure, but he is enjoying the beginning days of new parenthood, which means he's not getting any sleep. So he's going to have to be really careful. What we're talking about today might be helpful information to him, because loss of sleep is sometimes a major reason that pain might crop up in the body. We're talking about pain management in our program today. Kim Litwack is here, and she's nurse practitioner with Advanced Pain Management. We've been talking about some of the situations, the health concerns that create a great deal of pain. And we talked about back pain, headaches, migraines being really big issues for a lot of people and debilitating issues where they can't function. A couple of other areas of pain that are all-encompassing involve the pain surrounding cancer, cancer treatments, and certainly cancer that is escalating. And so how do you work with people, with cancer patients?
Well, I have to say the oncologists in Wisconsin do an outstanding job with pain management because they're treating not only the underlying disease, but the effects of that disease, and as you mentioned, the effects of the treatment. But we are available and are very willing to help and consult for patients who either need additional help or work with oncologists. Sometimes the cancer is not surgically removable. The patient has to have we'll deal with what we call palliative care, where we try and deal with the symptoms as opposed to the removal or treatment of that cancer. Sometimes the pain associated with cancer is just nausea from the radiation or the chemotherapy. So there's an interdisciplinary approach that we use to treat cancer pain depending on the effects that need to be managed.
And the nausea, you would put that in the category of pain?
Well, for many patients, nausea mm-hmm. is just absolutely awful, and most people would prefer to do just about anything than be nauseated for days and hours on end. So yeah, we'll treat pain management. We will use antiemetics or anti-nausea medications. The act of even vomiting can be painful for patients, so we want to try and keep nausea under control. And the other big reason to keep nausea under control is so that nutritional status can be maintained.
So it's connected with the health of the patient going through all of this treatment too. Is it true that if you are a cancer patient, that you can go through the experience pain-free or relatively pain-free?
Oof, I wish I could make that guarantee. Yeah. I'd like to say that we could make it as comfortable for all patients as possible.
So it's not zero. Not necessarily, no.
Wishful thinking,
yes,
nothing
right,
is zero.
Right. But you do have you have scales that you use, and explain that. I know I've always, from a scale of 1 to 10, what would you say your number is? And is that the main one, and is that the most effective one?
Well, it's the most accurate? Common, and it's the easiest for patients and caregivers to use. And so it's very, very widely used. Patients who have surgery will hear it in the hospital from the bedside nurse on a scale of 1 to 10. And what it really does is it emphasizes the individual nature of pain, because a 10 for you may be very, very different than a 10 for me.
But you take it as seriously.
Absolutely.
Okay. And if you hear those numbers, what do they mean to you? If you hear a number from, you know, 1 to 3 or 2 to 4 or whatever, in your professional then mind, how mm-hmm. does that relate the level of pain? What am I telling you?
Well, if someone's come in and says their pain's a 1 or a 2 or a 3, it might be mild, but it still means they've come to my office. So for them, it may be mild, but it may be enough of an annoyance that they still want to deal with it. For others, we use it as an indication that we're moving in the right direction and getting their pain under control. If they came in and their pain was an 8 or a 9 or a 10 and just miserable, we try and get it down as low as possible, but low doesn't always mean zero. Mm-hmm. For many patients, if we got it down to a 5, they're able to sleep, they're able to work. They still have pain, but it's much more manageable.
What number tells you that somebody is really, really in pain? I mean, besides 10. I mean, where's the breaking line?
Well, sometimes they'll come in and say it's a 15. Forget it's a 10, right. It's a 15. Any number that a patient reports is brought them into my office. So if they say it's a 1 or a 2, my next question would be, are you okay with that level?
Okay.
And if they're not, then we come up with an intervention. If they are, I may see them just on an as-needed basis as opposed to a regular basis.
What other measurements are there for pain?
We also ask quality kinds of issues. What does pain impact? What are you not able to do? So it's not just the pain score, because someone with a score of 5 may be able to go to work, may not be able to go to work, may need restrictions at work. So we want to know what the effect of that pain is, not just what their pain score is.
I guess that would be what the symptoms of pain are, how you can actually function.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Can you get up in the morning? Can you take care of your kids? Can you get to work? Can you sleep at night? All of them are important.
And then fibromyalgia. That's something that is seemingly to be a condition that more and more people are experiencing. What is fibromyalgia, and what can you do for it?
Well, I don't know if it's that more patients are experiencing fibromyalgia in that, or a better way to look at it is that more patients are actually getting diagnosed with mm-hmm. fibromyalgia. It's a generalized muscle condition.
We're hearing more about it.
Absolutely. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Absolutely we are. It's a generalized muscle pain condition where patients have very, very tender spots both above and below the waist and on the left and right side of their body. It often contributes to generalized fatigue, inability to sleep. It interferes with activities of daily living, but it's generalized musculoskeletal pain from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet.
And so what can you do about it?
Oh, boy. lifestyle modifications lead the list. Keeping active, whether it's warm water pool therapy, whether it's engaging in a low-impact, non-impact exercise like walking, elliptical trainer, being in a pool.
So non-impact is important.
Right. No high impact. Nothing that jars the joints. Running is not high on the list. But walking or being in a pool to keep moving. Being involved in activities that bring you joy because your body hurts. So you want to be finding pleasure activities that kind of move your mind to a better space. And then there are medications that can be used as well.
It seems elusive.
Absolutely.
People and their fibromyalgia is flaring up. And what's happening when it flares up?
Oh, it could be an injury, something as simple as bumping your toe on the bed frame when you're making the bed in the morning and it causes it to flare. It can be weather changes. It can be too much shoveling, sleeping in a bed that's not your own.
And then there's shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, now they have a vaccine for shingles, which is good. But people are just, it changes their lives for years if they get the post-herpetic pain afterwards?
Yes, ma'am.
So explain shingles and that pain and what you can do about it. Because I have many, many friends, and actually I've had an experience with shingles myself and didn't have the resulting pain afterwards. But it's just terrible.
It is a very, very intense burning pain that travels along a nerve pathway. It's due to the herpes virus that lays dormant in the body. And some people never get it when exposed, and other people do. And some people get shingles pain once and never get it again. Other people it can be recurrent. But it's a very intense pain that travels a nerve pathway.
It seems very difficult after people have experienced it, even if it calms down, and it can take sometimes years, just from a layperson's perspective, they never seem to bounce back 100%. It's just kind of took something out of them.
Oh, it does. It sucks the life right out of you when you experience it. And it's a dormant virus and something activates it. So patients are responding. Their body is fighting a virus. And so the development of a vaccine is huge.
Mm-hmm. And everybody over age 60 should get that vaccine.
Absolutely. Work with your healthcare provider.
Yes. What do you do for that kind of shingles pain?
We have topical medications in the form of patches and creams that can be used. Others, we use those medications that I mentioned before, the neuromodulators. We've gone as invasive as putting in implantable therapies as well to modulate those nerves.
Amazing.
It's a tough thing to treat.
Yeah, very, very difficult. But you have different options of treatment, and so people should get to their healthcare provider and not just try to live with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for any type of pain, I would encourage folks, if you have time, visit our website at apmhealth.com. You'll find visual representations and some visual in terms of short movies that show lots of different interventions that are available for not just shingles pain, but for headache and back pain and fibromyalgia as well. There are lots of options. And whether you talk about it with us or with your own provider, know that there are options out there.
Is this one of the frustrating parts of your field, is getting the word out to people that there is help available?
Absolutely. And radio shows like this and magazines from Reader's Digest to Scientific American are talking about pain. And there are lots and lots of interventions possible. You don't have to just live with it.
We're going to stop for a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of this laundry list of treatments, and some a little bit out of the box, so to speak.
Sure.
And the effectiveness, what they are, and how effective they really are and what they're supposed to accomplish. We're talking about pain management today with Kim Litwack, a nurse practitioner, PhD in nursing, and her expertise is all about pain. Here on All About Living on Madison 1670 WTDY. This segment of our program has been brought to you by Home Health United. You got a friend right here, online at homehealthunited.com. www.thepetsmart.org. I'm Carol Colby, and we'll be right back after these messages. And we're back with our last few minutes with Kim Litwack. Once again, Jason, you may be not be listening, you may be changing diapers, but congratulations to Jason Staple, and the regular producer of our program. He and his wife Katie had their third baby this week. Little Sam Stapleman was born. And so we're just all thrilled for Katie and for Jason and for little Sam's brother and sister, Lane and Henry. So you stay home and take care of the baby and your lovely family, Jason, and we'll see you back here soon. Our guest today on All About Living is Kim Litwack, and she's a nurse practitioner and a PhD in nursing, working in the field of advanced pain management. Working with advanced pain management, that's the organization that she represents. And there's so much that can be done with any kind of pain today. And the laundry list of treatments is amazing, and it continues to grow. And I want to talk about some of these seemingly obscure treatments, Kim. Magnets, how are they used for pain, and how effective are they?
Well, I'll be honest, we do not use magnets at Advanced Pain Management, but there are a number of people that do, particularly for arthritis pain. And there are a number of therapies available where patients will apply magnets to the outside of knees, in particular, elbows, joints. And for many patients, they report that they work. We don't have clinical evidence in terms of research to support that they work, but they don't interfere with anything. And if they work and provide pain control, we're all for it.
Well, there are a couple things I think at play here. First of all, we're all individuals and really complex individuals and unique, like snowflakes. And so what works for one person may not work for another for that reason. So you just never know how one person is going to react. Secondly, there's also a placebo effect that can be successful as well, isn't there?
Probably so. Any intervention is better than no intervention. But for many people, magnets work. And they don't interfere with anything, assuming you don't have a pacemaker and you're not putting your magnet near your pacemaker. But if it works, and for whatever reason it works, there may be things we don't yet understand, go for it.
What about biofeedback? How is that utilized?
Biofeedback is an excellent therapy to help patients gain some control over escalating heart rates and anxiety that's often associated with pain. And for many people, allows them to control their breathing, control their heart rate, relax so that they can bring their pain score from an 8, 9, or 10 down to a 2, 3, or 4.
What about electrical stimulation?
Electrical stimulation can be a therapy performed by physical therapists, can also be performed by pain management specialists, which helps quiet the nerves. It interrupts that nerve transmission of intense, deep pain with an alternative cycle.
Does that work well with chiropractic treatments, or what do chiropractic treatments do that some of these other types of treatments don't?
We do involve chiropractors in our care. Sometimes we get referrals from chiropractors. We also refer patients back to their chiropractors. Chiropractors use a number of therapies, manipulation of joints, movement, deep heat, ultrasound, stretching, strengthening.
Some of these treatments, they don't involve having to take drugs or having to be cut by a knife. So do you like to use those kinds of things that are the least invasive or least ingestive?
Absolutely, because patients have the most control over them. They don't need to come to me for a prescription. They don't have to go to the hospital for surgery. We'd like to give them skills and abilities to manage things independently. So the more we can do that, the better.
So the more you empower the patient, empower the individual, the better the pain is managed.
Absolutely.
And then acupuncture is used. Now, that goes way back into the Eastern culture. And it seems to be quite effective.
Thousands of years of use. For some patients, it's very, very effective for multiple pain syndromes. And there are a number of providers in Madison that use acupuncture. We do not use that in our Madison office, but some of our other clinics do.
The narcotic drugs, there's always a concern about becoming dependent on them. And I was told when I was put on some pretty powerful drugs, that when you're dealing with pain, that dependency is really not an issue, that you don't become dependent on them if you're taking them as recreational drugs. Is that...
Well, dependency also refers to how your body would react if we remove them suddenly. But yes, if narcotics are used appropriately when there is pain to be dealt with, they're an appropriate therapy. We want patients to be safe when they use them. They should be on the lowest dose possible. And we try and limit the use as much as possible.
And how dangerous are they?
Narcotics can be very dangerous when used by people who are using them inappropriately. And as a result, we ask all of our patients who we prescribe narcotics to, everyone is on a narcotic contract, and one of the statements in that narcotic contract is they are responsible for keeping those medications safe. Just because it has a label from the pharmacy doesn't mean it's a safe medication, and patients have to be part of the team in keeping those medications away from people that shouldn't be taking them, including children.
Mm-hmm. So there's a whole arena of responsibility around that level of treatment, but sometimes it's necessary.
Absolutely.
And it can be effective.
Absolutely.
What about cognitive behavioral therapy? Now, that doesn't involve having to be cut or ingest anything.
Right. That, again, involves the use of our pain psychologists to help patients understand the effects of pain, to come up with strategies including relaxation, biofeedback, and other therapies to help them have personal control over their pain management.
How much can mind over body really work, be effective?
Absolutely.
It does.
We find that patients who are more willing to be proactive and take an active role in management as opposed to a dependent role in management do much better in their pain control and pain management.
What about hypnosis?
Hypnosis is another cognitive behavioral therapy that we can involve our pain psychologists with and some of our psychiatrists in managing to help patients deal with the anxiety and the depression that comes from pain.
So that can be effective too.
Absolutely.
Seems to me you have to have knowledge of a lot of different specialties and alternative therapies and really know what they're about and how they work and whether they're legitimate or not and bring them all together.
And so, that's what makes the specialty of pain management.
Yeah, it's like a clearinghouse.
Absolutely.
Wow, it's just amazing. What about antidepressants? Is it because that people can get so down from the pain, or could depression in itself be creating some levels of pain?
Well, pain, again, is very depressing for many people because they don't feel like there's an end. So it does change how you react as a wife or a mother or a husband. So we use antidepressants to treat depression. But we found that some antidepressants, for example, Cymbalta, not only is an antidepressant, but it also modulates the nerves and helps with nerve pain.
And there's another one with the nerve pain, the gabapentin, the Neurontin.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's actually a drug that is used in treating epilepsy.
Correct.
And these seem to be working with nerve pain issues.
Well, one of the realizations was in epilepsy, during seizure activity, the nerves are misfiring or they're not being coordinated. And in chronic nerve pain, the nerves are misfiring and not behaving like they should. And so we have found through research that those medications work on chronic pain as well as seizures.
And would that be any neuropathy? I know neuropathy with patients who have diabetes or other issues of circulation where the nerves are really hurting at the ends where the nerve ends are damaged. How do you treat that?
We can use neuromodulators with those diseases as well. And the biggest objective with diabetic neuropathy is getting the diabetes under the best control possible to prevent further neuropathy.
Any other ways to treat the neuropathy? I hear, and that's something with aging people, their feet, their hands, the nerve pain is something that's almost unbearable.
Medications are probably the mainstay for management of neuropathy.
And what range of medications?
Again, the neuromodulators, things to quiet down those irritated nerves.
Okay.
Yep.
So we're back to those anticonvulsants. Finally, one of the things is exercise and the lifestyle. And as we conclude the program today, repeat and go over the power of what we do in our daily lives to modulate any kind of pain and prevent it and treat it and be successful in managing and not let it control our lives.
Well, I would say the best thing is to be good to your body. Feed it well, feed it right, keep the weight as low as possible, stay active as possible, allow your body to rest at night. Good decision making about how you lift, how you shovel, how you deal with Wisconsin winters. And when your body doesn't cooperate and pain interferes with your ability to get up, get moving, take care of your children, take care of your job, recognize that you don't have to live with pain. And before you allow pain to take over your life, recognize that primary care and a specialty like advanced pain management can help so that it doesn't take over your life.
And exercise seems to be the miracle drug of today's concept of good living. Is there anything that we should avoid in exercise?
Your body will tell you what you shouldn't do. So listen to your body. If you've not been exercising and you're starting an exercise program, consult with your healthcare provider to make sure that you're safe and that person can help provide some good recommendations for you.
Well, once again, good living is the first line of treatment for the prevention and the management of pain and other things that can occur in our lives as well. Kim, you have really enlightened us on handling pain, given us great hope that if we are suffering from pain in any number of ways, there's something that can be done about it. Kim Litwack, nurse practitioner with Advanced Pain Management. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTVY. I'm Carol Kobe. Now go out and have a great rest of the weekend.